Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeed.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Saturday, July 19th, 2014, and this is show number 480. Well, what the heck's the show doing out on a Saturday? Well, it turns out I'm leaving today to spend about a week on the beach with Steve's family in Santa Barbara, but I couldn't leave you without a show before I left. I know, it's annoying to hear me talk about going on vacation when I'm retired anyway, so we won't dwell on that. I also know that Marianne will be worried about who's taking care of Buzzy while we're gone. But don't worry, our good friend Brandy will be staying at the house to take care of her. Tesla, on the other hand, is off to summer camp, where she'll come back exhausted but happy from a week frolicking with her other dog friends. Next week's show will be hosted by Bart, so please, if you've got a review or a cool gadget or a fun tech tip, Mac, Windows, Linux, iOS, Android, Windows Phone, we take them all. Please send them to Bart at podcast@bartificer.net. That's BARTIFICER.net. And of course, there's a link in the show notes to his email address. And please don't leave it until Saturday or it might not make the cut. Many thanks in advance to Bart and those of you who help him out. Well, I'm getting really excited. Clarify 2 is supposed to be coming out next week. I've done a screencast for Don McAllister's awesome screencast online tutorials and an article for SCO Mag, but those won't be out for a couple of weeks. I will be sure to let you know exactly when Clarify 2 hits the streets, but stay tuned because we're going to have a special discount code just for NoSilla Castaways. Last week, when I was going through my top 5 menu bar apps, I explained how to bring up the keyboard viewer to put the cool accents on your letters. After I posted that, both David Allen, also known as A20Q on Twitter, and Jonathan Cost, also known as MacTipsDaily on Twitter, sent me tweets reminding me that if you hold down a key on the Mac keyboard for longer than normal, you get a pop-up with choices of letters with accents. I had totally forgotten about that. I only remember that's there when I'm not trying to get an accent. I'm trying to do a repeated letter. Let's say somebody posts something appalling. I might want to write, no, but instead I get the option now to add an umlaut to my O, which is not what I want. I wish you could toggle this feature off because I do repeated letters way more often than I do accents. But good on David and Jonathan for reminding us that there's a way easier way to get accents than the convoluted keyboard viewer that I told you about. Well, we've got a really big show today. First, I'm going to tell you how I made Fire, also known as how I fixed Pat's WordPress installation. Then Dorothy has a real productivity boosting app to tell us about. A little bit of sarcasm there. Then I'm going to talk to Linda Decker, also known as NY Linda, also known as Normal Person. I'm going to talk to her on the phone about her experience upgrading Microsoft Office. You're going to love it. In Chit Chat Across the Pond, we have an extended version of Security Light with Bart, along with a bite-sized episode of Taming the Terminal, Part 19 of N. As I've mentioned a few hundred times, I use blogging software called WordPress to create podfeed.com. I am definitely not an expert, but after 9 years of using it, I can pretty much muddle my way through. The good news is that both Bart and my buddy Niraj are experts in WordPress and the underlying technologies, so when things get too dicey, they're usually there to hold my hand. Now, technology is something that we all pass along to people who know less than we do. I always say that no matter how much you know, there's someone who knows more, but no matter how little you know, there's someone who knows less. The only thing I worry about is that each time the information is replicated down, flowing downhill, it might get a little more messed up, like too many photocopies. Doesn't stop me from passing the knowledge along, though. So I've got Bart and Raj knowing more than me and helping me, and then I got to help my good friend Pat learn the basics of WordPress. She's brilliant and knows so much I don't know about other Mac things, and she often helps me, so it's fun to be able to help her get started with WordPress. She came over to the house and we had a nice geek playdate. Then I left her on her own for a few weeks to mess around with themes and plugins and such. I presumed all was well, but this week I got an email from her that read, "A tale of woe, or Pat did something stupid. I was going along great, decided to try buy a new plugin called Essential Grid. Love it! Installed it, watched a few videos, made some tweaks, hit a couple of roadblocks. I was poking around in my WordPress settings to see why if I hit new post, it wasn't posting in the grid. It wasn't even posting in the blog page. Then I saw something shiny. I remembered I wanted to change my site from yourmacdoctor.com to patdanglerconsulting.com. There was a setting for that, so I did it. Now I can't get to my site. It's gone. Poof. Long story, now I'm going for a walk, hoping you might take pity on me, even tap me on the head and say something like, oh, all you have to do is..." Okay, so I saw that email, and I got a hold of Pat, and I said, let's just get onto Skype and do a screen share so I could try to figure out what she'd done. Let me step back for a minute and give the basics again on how WordPress works, because it's going to be important to the story. I've described this before, but I think it's good to review each time. WordPress sits on top of four technologies. You need an operating system, a web server, a programming language, and a database. It's very common to build this on a set of open source technologies. The operating system is Linux, the web server is Apache, the programming language is called PHP, and the database is in MySQL. Linux, Apache, PHP, and MySQL together are called the LAMP stack. Get it? L-A-M-P. WordPress takes things you write, like blog posts, and puts them in the database, in this case, MySQL. Any settings you change in the WordPress interface are also stored in MySQL. This will become very important to the story later. Pat was using the WordPress interface to mess around in her website and found two places where she could change her URL. She explained that in the long run, she wants to move to the new website name, and as she said, there was something shiny, so she typed the URL she wanted to see. Let me explain this in the real world. Imagine the address of your house is 123 Main Street, but you've always wanted an elegant address like 456 Beverly Boulevard. If you started telling everyone that was your address, they'd find nothing when they got there. That's essentially what Pat did to herself. She simply changed the address, but there's nothing at that address. I should mention that she had changed two URLs. The first one is called the home setting, which is the address people type into the browser, and the second was the site URL, which is where her core WordPress files reside. By changing both of these, it made life more complicated. For example, if she just wrecked her home URL, her site would have disappeared, but we'd have still been able to get into WordPress and just change it back. But because she changed her WordPress files location, we were in a bit of a mess. I should say, she didn't move the files location, she removed the pointer to the files. The files didn't move. I knew we weren't in a truly catastrophic state because our server still had all of our files, and we'd still be able to go poke around in them because they didn't actually move. Only WordPress thought they did. We could use an FTP client to connect to the server to fix things. FTP stands for File Transfer Protocol, and it's basically a way of pushing files up to a server on a network and pulling them back down. I knew that structure was undamaged. We just had to figure out how to get back into WordPress to connect it again. One of the great reasons to use an open source and widely used tool like WordPress is that there are a gazillion people out there writing for it and helping each other get things fixed when you break them. I did a bit of the Googles, and I found instructions over at WordPress.org on how to fix those URLs if you muck it up. Evidently, Pat was not alone in not being able to resist the temptation to play with these settings. The good news is that the instructions gave four ways to fix the problem. I'm going to go through each of the solutions. First, they suggested editing the functions.php file. This is a file that lives inside your theme. Let me back up a minute to explain that your theme file gets called by WordPress to produce the look and feel of your site. It tells WordPress things like, make my font this size, I want to have a two-column layout, I want the two columns arranged in this way, I want to change the color of my links to look like that, and pretty much everything else visual. The theme file has no actual content in it. You can swap out a theme file at the push of a button, and the site will dramatically change, but all of the content will be the same. The instructions said to edit the theme's function.php file by entering two lines, one for each type of URL she changed. The line they put in had the term update_option and the type of URL to change, and then the correct URL, all in the PHP programming language syntax with quotes and all kinds of other stuff. Remember PHP? That's the P in LAMP. Pat followed these instructions to the letter while I watched on Skype, and still her site was down. All right, let's try another one of their solutions. They also suggested editing a file called wp-config.php. This file contains information about where your database is, the database name, and the database user. You create it during the very first steps of installing WordPress, and you pretty much should leave it alone after that. Much like the change suggested in the first solution, we were instructed to insert two lines. In this case, they started with the word define, followed by the URL type and the correct URL. And that didn't fix the problem either. I have no idea why that didn't work. The third solution was terrifying to me. They suggested we go into the MySQL database and find the places where she changed the URLs and put them back to the original values. Remember I said early on that MySQL, as the database, simply stores all of the data you enter, like any settings in WordPress? So that imaginary URL Pat typed in was the data in the database somewhere. To get into MySQL, that meant entering the dreaded land of PHP MyAdmin. This is a web-based interface to the database that I've been in many, many times. But every time I've been in there, someone was holding my hand and I was gripping it very tightly. Niraj dragged me into PHP MyAdmin and was a very patient teacher, but I was always terrified I'd bork something up. I mean, this is the real data. You can really mess things up if you do this wrong. Bart also tried to calm my nerves when he taught me, but I'm still pretty afraid to go in there. So here I am, standing on the brink of this adventure, hearing in my head the words, "Winter is coming with doom," but I step forward anyway. Heck, it's Pat's website, not mine, right? In all seriousness, this was an experimental version at this point, so I wasn't pulling her entire site down, but she had put a lot of work into it, and she did have a very recent backup, so the risk was smaller than I'm making it sound. Luckily, again, the instructions were very well written, and we were able to follow them quite easily. You launch PHPMyAdmin from the control panel of your web hosting company, and right there you can see your database and open it up. Down the left side of the screen is a list of all the tables in the database. They told us to look for a table called WP_options and then to click on Browse. Well, so far that pretty much makes sense. Next, they said to look for a record called Site URL. Sure enough, there it was with Pat's imaginary URL right next to it. We hit the pencil to edit that record and change the URL back to the right one. From there, we repeated the steps to find the home field and put its URL back as well. We click go to save, and I was 100% confident that this would work. And it didn't. Oh, come on. How could this not work? We changed it in the database, for crying out loud. I looked at the fourth solution, but ran away quickly because it was talking about how to relocate an entire WordPress installation as a way to trick WordPress into finding its way back home. I didn't even understand the beginning of the instructions on the fourth solution. Sadly, while I thought I was going to be able to fix this on my own, I had to call Niraj. Luckily, he took my call and had just enough time to tell me how to search for the errant URL term in the database to see if it was hiding in yet another field, but then he had to run off to work. We did the search, but it wasn't in a third place. So we know we fixed the database. How could it not work? I was dejected and told Pat that I'd run out of ideas and that she'd probably have to call her hosting company, who probably could have fixed this by that time anyway. But I just didn't want to give up. I noodled it for a long time. I just kept looking at it and thinking and looking and thinking and made her just sit there watching me think. And finally, I had an epiphany. What if the fact that I solved the problem three different ways was making things step on each other? I had Pat go back into functions.php and erase the two lines we'd entered and then back into config.php and get rid of those lines. And guess what? It worked. It worked. I was so excited. I have to tell you, I felt like Tom Hanks when he made fire in the movie Castaway. It was a wonderful feeling. I started dancing in my chair and singing, "I am your hero," to Pat. She was as happy as I was, so she had to put up with my singing. I feel like the training wheels have been taken off, that maybe I can occasionally go into my databases, actually making sure I have a good database backup first, and maybe I could fix things of my own. I am very proud of my little self.
Mac Lurker here with a review of the Picasso Paint app for iPad. Normally we start with a problem to be solved. However, I'm not so sure there's really a problem here. This may be a solution in search of a problem. The Picasso app is a painting app that will bring out the artistic side of your cat. You start by selecting a few parameters, colors to use, canvas color, painting style. Then you place your iPad in front of your cat and tap start. A very realistic mouse scuttles around the display, chirping and making little scurrying noises. Hopefully the noise and movement attracts your cat's attention as he touches the display, attempting to catch the moving mouse. Splotches of paint appear in the colors you selected previously. After a few minutes of play, you can save the results to the iPad's camera roll, from where you can share your little darling's talent with the world. The noises and irregular motion of the mouse make the app very appealing for any cat, though I have to say our female Rocky could barely be bothered to wake up from her nap. And our male Jinxo was smart enough to figure out that the mouse was not on top of the iPad and attempted to burrow underneath. Either way, negative results on the art. But I'm sure your pawed Picassos will show much more aptitude. Picasso comes bundled with two other cat toy games, Catch Games and Cat Music Game. The Cat Music Game is incredibly silly and best experienced after several beers. You tap on kittens that are bouncing around the display. As you do that, each kitten reappears playing a musical instrument. But then after a few seconds, it takes off flying around the display again, and you have to tap it again to make it start playing music once more. Actually, more of a human game. Here, let me show you. Where was I? Oh, yes. The second game, called Catch Games, is really the better of the two. It provides a selection of six targets, each with accompanying sound effects, for your cat to chase around the iPad display. I suggest the fly target if you really want to annoy anyone in sound range, or the spider target if you need to creep out your family. The whole bundle is called Catch and Paint Games for Cats, available in the App Store, I think for free, from developer Martin Carlson. And this is Mac Lurker.
Well, Dorothy, I am glad your productivity has gone so much up so much recently with Picasso. I'm going to make a couple of corrections here. Number one, if you look for Picasso in the App Store, you will not find it. You need to look for Catch and Paint Games. It's a bundle that gives you all of these different things she was talking about. The other thing I'm going to correct is it was not free. It was actually $1.99. Now, I find this hilarious because Dorothy is one of the most... It's what I'm looking for. We'll go with frugal people I've ever met. And the fact that she spent $1.99 for something for her cats to goof around with is just hilarious to me. She did explain to me when I pointed that out that she had a gift card and she had a lot of money in there. And so $1.99 didn't sound that bad. But I still have to give her a hard time because, she's really frugal. I'm going to do something unusual now that I've never done before. I have called a woman named Linda Decker on the phone. She is going to give us a short rant. She's known as New York Linda in the chat room, NY Linda in the chat room for the live show, if you remember her. Linda is on the phone because she is a normal person who does not live for tech. For her, it's just a tool. She's a brilliant writer. She's a chef. She runs a small business, and she's one of the funniest people I know. While she does not have a technical bent, we like to refer to her as a reasonably bright girl. How you doing today, Linda?
I'm good, Al. How are you?
I'm doing good. So I wanted you to come on the show because you had sent me a message about a recent experience you had with Microsoft Office.
Uh-huh.
It went really well, huh?
Yeah. A note, it was like an encyclopedia, Al.
All right. So you're a Windows user, right?
Right.
And you depend on Microsoft Office for your business communications.
That's correct.
Now, you had a copy of Office, right?
But I've been using Office like for decades, I think.
Okay. So for some reason you decided you needed a newer version. What caused that?
Well, what happened was, you know, people started sending me documents with a DocX extension. And, you know, I got sick of annoying my friends by going, you know, I'm not a grown-up yet. Can you send that in .doc extension format?
Right.
And, you know, so my friends were getting a little irritated with me, my coworkers, you know, business associates. So I thought maybe it's time to, like, upgrade.
Right. So that's got to have been, so it's maybe 4 or 5 years old. But the software you had did everything you wanted, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was like a utility. You know, you turn on the faucet and the water comes out. In Microsoft Word, you open a blank document, you type, and bada bing, you're done.
So I like to talk on the show, as you know, about a problem to be solved. Mm-hmm. The only problem to be solved was that Microsoft changed the format for the documents.
Well, yeah, and I had no idea what was behind that, like what the new version was going to look like and what the user experience was going to be. I just knew that my friends were getting a little impatient with me, so I better upgrade.
Oh, dear. Okay, so the first thing you did, I think you said in your email you uninstalled was the first step?
Yeah, I had to uninstall the old version, and then it would, like, save all my documents and stuff or whatever housekeeping it does in the background. And then install the new version.
Okay, so uninstalling went quickly? It just took a couple seconds?
Well, no, it took a couple of minutes, but, you know, no biggie.
Okay.
And then I had a copy of the new version floating around somewhere on a disk. I installed that. The whole shebang took about 45 minutes.
Okay.
So we uninstalled, it saved my documents, it installed the new software. I presume it reinstalled all my documents and history and stuff.
Okay.
And I could see in the background this, you know, yay, you have new software. It's going to be really exciting. You're going to love it. And all you have to do is put in the activation key.
Okay.
So I put in the activation key, and it said, you know, I don't think so, Skippy. You've tried this too many times.
Are you a pirate?
Arr, matey. No, I really
you don't
have
pirate
no idea.
Software.
No, I have no idea who's been, you know, maliciously entering this activation key without my permission. So, you know, I finally got fed up with it and I had to go to Memphis, so I just kind of set it aside.
Okay.
And so I got down to Memphis. This was a very important mission. I was looking for stray sequins and sideburn hairs, you know, for souvenirs. I was going to bring you some, but they've cleaned the place, I guess. So then I get home, okay, and I have this package of documents that I need to submit by a deadline.
And you've forgotten what state you've left office in, right?
Exactly. Exactly. And Lonnie, who is my buddy in software crime, had left town to go visit his mom.
Okay.
So I'm here by myself. I try and open this letter that I had previously been working on, and I had no Microsoft Office software installed whatsoever. So I couldn't open a letter. I couldn't print a letter. I couldn't attach it to an email. No, nothing. And I've got this deadline hanging over the back of my neck, you know? So I figure, well, let's try this baby again. So I, again, try reinstalling the software, thinking, you know, maybe I made a typo when I was entering the activation key or something.
It's only 163 characters, right? How could you screw that up?
I know, exactly. Exactly. So I try it again. I get the same result. You know, I'm sorry, you've used up all of your tries on this activation key. So I figure, look, I got to get this done. I'm going to just go buy the new software again.
Okay.
So
the
software
that you don't actually need, you're going to buy it again, right? But you got to get your job done.
Right. The software I not only don't need, don't want, but I already have a copy, but it won't let me use it. So I go to Microsoft.com or whatever it was, and it offers me two fabulous options. You're going to love this, Al. So for $9.99 a month, I can rent a copy of the home student version of Microsoft Office. I think it's 2013.
Okay.
But I have to give them my bank account number so they can, you know, ding me every month unless I stand up and scream and say, you know, cut it out.
So they have to, so they're going to reach into your bank account and suck money out. Not bill your credit card, suck money directly from your bank account.
Right, once a month until I scream uncle. My second fabulous opportunity there was to go for a year for $99. So I'm saving, $20?
2 months worth of payment.
Yeah. Exactly. But same deal. I have to give them my checking account number so they can go take money out on a monthly basis. And I don't like that idea. I know many people find that convenient. You know, like for my auto insurance, I can understand the value of it not expiring accidentally. But this is retarded, all right? Excuse me, I didn't mean that to be an insult, but you got to be
ridiculous.
Kidding me. Yeah. So I decide I'm going to start up a live chat.
It's like the 11th hour. You've been working on this by this time. So,
yeah,
so your new little friend Bobby is real helpful then?
I don't know what kind of a remote being it was, but I believe in retrospect it must have been a zombie, you know, based on how quickly my questions were answered with irrelevant scripts. So I'd say, like, how do I buy a permanent license to this stuff? And, oh, I am so sorry that you are being inconvenienced. I am here to support and help you. It's like, fine, where is the software so I can buy a permanent life of my PC version. So, Al, I don't want to drag your listeners through this ad nauseum, but it took forever to finally go, well, I guess you can get one of those for $139.
Okay, so you can pay once instead of for the rest of your life.
Right, and I can keep my bank account information to myself. So it turns out that this is, I hope nobody is going to pass this around, but it's super secret. Nobody's supposed to know that you can just pay once for $139.
I didn't think you could do it anymore. Wow.
So the zombie had to email me a top secret link for me to click on, and I did that.
Uh-huh.
And I downloaded the software, and it installed, and it came up. In the background, it said, okay, all you have to do is put in the activation key. Click here. So I click here. Nothing happens. You know, it kind of blinks. You know how when you click on the click here button, it kind of winks at you?
Yeah.
Wink, 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 wink. Hello? What's going on? Wink, wink. Is anybody home? Oy. So I decide I better get on the phone with these guys. And I do.
Oh, my God. And now you're on the phone with them?
Now I'm on the phone. I mean, how long have we been at this now? A couple of weeks?
Yeah.
I don't know. Jeez. I don't know. So, all right. So I get this robotic voice, and it wants me to read with my voice over the telephone a 42-digit activation code, and it's broken into seven six-digits of numbers.
You're not kidding. It's 42 digits?
No, I'm not kidding.
It's not an exaggeration. Oh, my God.
No, I'm not making this up. How could I forget? Okay, so, but this robot's favorite phrase is, I didn't get that. Please try again. So I finally managed to get it to understand all 42 of my numbers.
I think you're a pirate.
So then it wants to tell me its 42 top secret digits. But it doesn't tell me that after each six numerals, I need to say loudly and clearly, continue.
Oh, so it's reading it back to you now?
No, it's giving me 42 new numerals that I am to type into little boxes.
Oh, so, okay, so that's why it's waiting for continue, so you have time to type the six in.
I guess. I mean, I'm
really... But they didn't
really,
tell you that.
I really don't know. So I finally get all the way through it. And again, with the, I'm sorry, I didn't get that. Please try again. Please say continue. And I'm like, you know, what do you want from my life is evidently not a valid response. Exactly.
We want your checking account, Linda. That's what we actually want.
Oh, man. So I finally get all 42 digits typed in properly. And now, you know, I'm getting access to the cuneiform tablets that have been unearthed in Egypt, judging from the complexity of this process. So now I have to send this email unencrypted to Uncle Bill to get permission to use my utilities.
Wait, you have to email them? What do you have to email them?
I have to email them. First of all, it showed me my 42 digits that I had to read aloud.
Right.
And then the robot wanted to tell me its top secret 42 digits that I had to type in.
Right.
And then I have to email it to Uncle Bill. That's what I call Microsoft, Uncle Bill Gates, right?
Oh, my gosh.
But it's unencrypted. After all this, I need to send an unencrypted email. And so now the robot is waiting. Did you send the email? Yes, I did. Do you see an error message? It says. No, I'm sorry. I didn't get that. No error message.
Are you saying any non-Girl Scout safe words to it at this point?
Pickle. So it says, apparently, grudgingly, I don't know if robots actually have emotions, but it sounded grudging to me. Your software is now activated.
Yay! Do you feel like you've made fire at this point?
I know. Or a wheel or something really basic. So I'm thinking, you know, this is utterly ridiculous. Anything in this world did not need to be updated. It's how to type a letter.
So you basically want the functionality that you pretty much had on a typewriter in the 1970s.
Right? I don't need anything else, right?
Right. Right.
So the first thing that happens now that I have access to the Rosetta Stone is that it wants to show me this chipper little video explaining how delighted I'm going to be to feel like a moron learning how to type a letter again. Yay! Nothing is where you thought it was before.
So how do you like the ribbon, Linda?
Red on the bottom, black on top. My favorite, right? So I go, all right, I am running out of time here. It's like late on a Friday afternoon, and I promised to get this stuff in this week. So I try and open a blank document. Y'all, there are 83... choices of blank documents. I said 83, and I'm not making that number up. You can go check it yourself. How blank can a blank document get? Yeah, so it's got all these formatting codes built into it. Like in one version of the blank document, the first thing you type is going to be centered and like 84 point Times New Roman, and, you know, like, you can't figure out how to make a title, or I don't know. So I finally find a really blank document, and I go and I copy from a previous email a block of text, and I'm going to, you know, put it to my clipboard, go back into Word, and put it into that virgin document.
Uh-huh.
I figure I've done this, you know, 5 billion times. It says, well, what clipboard copy version do you want to use?
What?
I know.
I don't even know what that means.
I didn't know what it meant either, but at this point I was feeling murderous. Okay, I have a lot of sharp knives around here because I cook a lot. And I was like, it's a good thing I'm home alone, because anybody within throwing distance would be dead. I have had it with you. I don't need four kinds of clipboard-based functions. I just want to type a document, and I'm running out of time.
Jeez. Did you finally beat it into submission?
I did. And so here, this grand package of documents, just to keep it simple, there was an email with a letter attached saying, you know, referring to our conversation, there's a copy for your convenience attached. And then I had to go into another program, like QuickBooks, and create a financial report and attach that. And bang, I'm done. So I go up in the cloud, which I'm not liking either, and we won't get into that subject. But I go up in the cloud, and I make my profit and loss statement, and I save it, and I call it creatively profit and loss statement first half 2014, and I convert it to PDF format, and I think I'm putting it in my document folder. And why are you laughing? I'm like going to kill somebody.
The word think.
Oh. So I go to get it, right? It's not there. It is NOTTHERE. It is not there. I got to catch my breath. I mean, this is, at this point, so I go back
in. You're
ready
to throw knives again.
I know. So I have to go back in, recreate the report. By this time, I've forgotten how to make each month turn into its own column. But I do manage to do it, and then I want to email it to myself so I can then open that, copy it, and attach it to the really important documents I need to send within like 3.5 minutes at this point. But no, I can't do that because QuickBooks, and I'm, you know, off of Microsoft here for a second, but QuickBooks will not let me change the from email address. It has to be Lonnie's screen name, but he's not here, so I have to call him on his cell phone at his brother's house where he's grilling sausage for the family to get his email password so I can email myself this report, receive it, and attach it to this new email with the brand spanking new letter. And send it off. But by this time, the sheer electromagnetic force of my frustration has scrambled the paper on my desk. And I have to go digging like this architectural dig to find that woman's email address to send my masterpiece.
Wow. Did it occur to you at this point that you could have gotten some stones in the backyard and used those knives to carve the letter and ship it faster?
Right, cuneiform. I was thinking cuneiform at one point in the process.
Wow. Now, I know that a lot of people listening are yelling into their portable devices, oh, Linda, all you had to do was... But mm-hmm. I didn't want to interrupt Linda with that because I thought of some solutions along the way, too. But this is what normal people are dealing with in today's technological environment, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this isn't you shouldn't have to know the trick of, oh, all you have to do is, in order to do something like type a freaking letter.
Right. Right. As much as I admire and adore you tech geeks, I'm not one of you. I have my own group of freaks, my own tribe. All I want to do is type a letter, send an email, find out how much money I have in my bank account. That's it.
Really? Well, Linda, I really appreciate you coming on and telling this story because I think you told it in a way that all of us can appreciate.
My pleasure, Al. All anytime.
Right. Talk to you again soon.
Bye.
Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond, and we are back with Bart Bouchatz. Let's get started today. Bart, we got a lot on the table, huh?
We do. This always happens when I've been away for a while. It's been 3 weeks again, or 2 weeks, or it's been not the normal amount of time.
Yeah.
And this time, the security gods decided that the summer was not to be quiet, and we should have lots of news.
Okay. Let's go.
Okay. So, the last time we had no updates at all. Now we have Patch Tuesday has been and gone, which means that Adobe and Microsoft have dropped an absolute, you know, excrement load of updates, so patch those. Apple were busy with updates to OS 10, which is 10.9.4 and security update 2014.003. Then iOS got a security update to 7.1.2. Then older versions of Safari got a security update. And then the Apple TV got a security update. So patch all of those.
Wow. That's pretty much the, my iPod Nano didn't get updated. That's about it.
Yeah, but everything I own with an Apple device got, or an Apple logo on the back of it, got something. Yeah.
Wow.
Oracle then released a critical patch for Java. If you still have it installed, update it. If you don't have it installed, yay. If you have it installed but have no reason to, maybe remedy that. Update it or delete it, but don't do nothing.
Okay.
Microsoft were forced to issue an emergency patch because...
Backing up on the Java, would you know if you had... would you get any kind of notification that you needed to update Java?
I have Java on my work machine because I have no choice, and it popped up a message to me to say you need to update.
Okay, good.
So, that is good that Oracle are doing that in their versions of Java. Microsoft were forced to release an emergency patch because an Indian certificate authority, who is only trusted by Microsoft and not by Firefox or by Chrome, seems to have lost control of itself because there were certificates for Google domains fraudulently issued by that certificate authority.
Ooh.
So that is not good. This really only affects IE users because no one else was ever going to accept these certificates as valid. But it's good that it's patched all the same.
Why is that? Why would only IE be...
Well, because Firefox never trusted the certificate authority.
Oh, okay. Got you.
Yeah. So it would always have been a bogus cert.
And Safari didn't either?
No, Apple didn't either, so OS X unaffected, and Chrome didn't either. So.
Okay, good.
Adobe released an update to Flash, and it is a security update, but it's not because Adobe screwed up, which is a pleasant surprise.
Although, of course, bad press on it, but you explained it to me, so I'm looking forward to you explaining it here.
Well, I don't want to go into too much detail because we could pretty much do an entire hour-long podcast and explaining exactly the ins and outs of this, but basically, there is a technique that is used by people to build web services. It's called JSONP. I think it's an insane, stupid idea that should never be done because you're bypassing browser security, and that's just bad.
But anyway, when you JSON, right?
It's JSONP.
Right.
So JSON is a very common technique, and there's nothing wrong with JSON, but JSONP is a problem.
Okay.
The P doesn't stand for problem, but it should. and this affected pretty darn big sites like Tumblr and a whole bunch of Google properties. This is a big deal. So basically, JSONP is a technique for hacking around a browser security feature called the same origin policy. And if you hack around a security feature, you then take responsibility for protecting all of your users. And it turns out that a lot of people had JSONP endpoints that failed at that mission. They basically had a problem which allowed attackers to use Flash as a sort of a shim to exploit the fact that there were bad JSONP endpoints.
Oh.
And so the security researcher who discovered this problem did the whole responsible disclosure thing, which meant that most of the big sites had actually patched their JSONP implementations before it was announced that this problem existed, which is good.
Okay.
But for all of those other sites that are slow to update, that are not run by such good people, this problem exists. And it technically allows a bad guy to steal your cookies, which is bad because your cookies have your session information that could be used to log in as you. So in order to protect people from bad webmasters, Adobe added something into Flash to notice when it was being abused in this way.
Oh.
So Flash basically detected that it was being used to attack JSONP endpoints and just nipped it in the bud.
Oh, wow. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. So it's Adobe being very sensible, and they are using the fact that Flash is all over the place to protect users from bad JSONP endpoints. So I think hats off to Adobe, did the right thing. And I was so sad to see people say, Adobe patched yet another security flaw. And I was like, no, they're being the good guys for once. Be nice.
You know, Bart, this is one of the things I love about working with you is so many of us, and I think I fall into this camp more often than not, get a thing against a company forever, and therefore we can never say anything nice about them. And if Adobe does something right, man, you're going to be the first one saying they did it right. And if Apple does something stupid, you're going to be the first one saying they did something stupid. And that kind of balanced reporting, if you will, is something unique in you, I think.
Well, I have a thing for some companies against some other companies, but I have a stronger thing for justice. So that sort of trumps it. You know, I don't like Adobe. I make no bones about not liking Adobe. But when Adobe are treated unfairly, I really, really don't like unfairness.
Yeah, good.
So that balances it out. Because me and you are WordPress users, and I think a fair few of our listeners are, it's worth mentioning there was a critical update to WordPress. There was a bug that allowed people to basically make fake authentication cookies and therefore become an admin on your site without you allowing them to do so, which is bad.
Yikes.
So you should make sure that your WordPress is fully patched. And there was also a plugin called MailPoet, which has 1.7 million downloads, according to the tracker on WordPress.org. And that, too, had a serious problem. So if you have that plugin, patchy, patchy, patchy as well.
Yikes.
And then finally,
while you're talking, I'm going to go check my WordPress installation. It should be auto-updating, right?
It should, as of one of the recent WordPress updates. And with that nice new WordPress bar we've had, well, I say new, we've had it for years. But that makes it so obvious when you have an update because you have the icon, the little update icon with a number next to it. So it's much harder to have your WordPress out of date these days, which is good.
The only thing I worry about is there are sites I manage where I don't frequently go to them. You know,
yes.
I go every once in a while, I'll go poke around, see what's going on. Like if I find out about this, I'll go make the rounds and check on my sites that I don't actually actively deal with. That's where it gets dodgy. Yeah. Mine still says 3.9.1. Is that right?
3.9 is good because that's higher than 3.8, which I think is where the problem was.
Oh, okay, good. All righty.
And then finally, and then this whole Internet of Things thing, which is becoming very popular, a company called LifeX, I think is how you pronounce it, LIFX, they do LED light bulbs, and they have this cool thing where they use this kind of mesh network between your light bulbs so that you don't have to configure them and stuff. And unfortunately, their crypto was bad, very bad. Basically, they had one key for every single light bulb ever made burnt into the firmware.
Crypto and, for what? What kind of crazy thing am I hiding in my light bulb?
The key to your Wi-Fi network.
Wait, how could they burn into ROM the key for my Wi-Fi network?
No. They burn into ROM the encryption key they use when sending your Wi-Fi password between the light bulbs.
Oh.
Oops.
Okay.
So they released a firmware update. Which is good. I mean, at least they responded promptly. But we are going to see this in the Internet of Things. And in actual fact, I'm going to jump out of sequence here and say that in suggested reading, there's a story about hacking a Tesla as well. Right. So, you know, this is a new field, this Internet of Things, and it is security Wild West. So be warned. You know, play
by all
means.
Maybe haven't done this kind of work before and maybe aren't thinking about the things that people who've worked with regular computers, if you will, maybe.
Well, yeah, these are new companies doing cool new things, and they haven't quite had, you know, they haven't had years of being hammered on by the bad guys to, you know, temper the software.
Right. That's a perfect
And there's
word.
Also a lack of standards. I mean, these mesh networks are doing cool and clever things, but everyone's reinventing the wheel because no one has invented a good wheel yet.
Right.
And so until things settle down and things become standardized, you're going to have this happen. This is what happens with new technology. So I'm not saying don't do all the cool new stuff, but bear in mind, you're playing with new stuff, and I think Steve Gibson's advice is have a separate Wi-Fi network for all this kind of stuff and keep your computers in a nice, safe Wi-Fi network where you can play.
That's not a bad idea. I've got a guest network. I could be putting my Hue light bulbs on that instead of on my real network, huh?
Or, you know, just pick up a cheap airport, one of those little airports that fit the size of a plug. You know, pick up a little cheap router and throw up a new network. You know, it's easy to do.
Throw up on your network. Okay.
So that moves us into news. And goodness me, is there a lot of it. And I had 70 news items that I filtered down to this short list. And to put that into context, an entire month of Apple news usually comes to 80.
Wow.
When I'm preparing Let's Talk Apple. And what on earth is going on the last 2 weeks? But anyway. So let's race through it. There is a nasty bug in Android Key Store that affects certain versions of Android, and this, if you want to be horrified, read the Naked Security article, which does one of their, at this stage, patented fantastic takedowns of how this bug came to be. The source code starts with a wonderful comment that says, because the buffers are always going to be big enough, we've omitted buffer size checking. Of course, there was a buffer overflow, right? If you read something like that, you know you're into dangerous code. And, you know, they rip it apart. But again, we're down to the fact that because C is such a primitive language and it sort of doesn't bother checking the buffers for you, it leaves that up to you. And then when the programmer decides to get lazy and say, ah, no, sure, those buffers will always be big enough. Poop. Good news, then. Apple has rolled out two-step validation or verification to a whole boatload more countries. And I was going to read them all out until I saw the length of the list, and then I decided against it. But basically, it's about 30... No, it's easily 40 countries between Argentina and Vietnam.
Wow.
I mean, really, it's a lot. The link in the show notes is to a piece over a 9-to-5 Mac, and that has the full list, so you can check your country.
All right.
Now... there's a story I linked to because I think it's important that we understand how this is done. So this is utterly trivial, right? So there was a social media feed set up which appeared to have magically predicted the outcome of the World Cup before it actually happened. Therefore, starting off the conspiracy theory that the World Cup was rigged. But this is actually a really easy trick to do. And I think it's important that everyone understand how this trick is done because it could be used to perpetrate a really nasty hoax. So what you actually do here is you set up a social media account, you make the account private, you make posts in advance, way before the World Cup starts, and you make a post predicting every outcome, then you wait until the World Cup happens, you delete your thousands of wrong answers, then you make your profile public, and it will have a date in the past when you predicted the World Cup, and you are therefore a genius.
Wow. That's awesome.
Simple, simple trick, right? But imagine if that were applied to elections and someone tried to start a conspiracy theory that someone rigged an election.
Right, right.
Could easily be done. So it's important that we understand how easy it is to make it look like we were geniuses in hindsight with the simple act of deleting all of our wrong predictions.
Maybe that's what John C. Dvorak does.
Google have done something very good for the security world. They have launched something called Project Zero, which is an initiative within Google to actively seek out zero-day exploits in common software and then responsibly disclose them and make sure they're fixed.
Now, I heard that, Bart, and the way I heard it, maybe I heard it wrong, was that It was software bugs in software other than Google's.
Right. I mean, I don't know the exact software, but basically stuff like Apache and, you know, basically stuff that is used a lot. They're going to go actively hunting for problems, because you can rest assured, A, the bad guys are, and B, a whole bunch of state agents are as well. So the more good guys there are looking for bugs, the better. And what Google has said is when they find stuff, they will responsibly disclose. So they'll contact the vendor of the software. They won't make it public until it's patched, all the good stuff.
So the inference I made was that they weren't looking for bugs in their own software. But that's probably the correct inference, right? That's just not the purpose of this exercise.
Right, they have actually a very strong security team.
Okay.
In fact, it was a member of Google's security team discovered the bug that Adobe got all that praise from me for fixing.
Okay.
So that Rosetta bug was found by Google. So,
okay.
You know, Google have a good, strong security team. And so this is basically, they've been doing it sort of on that sort of blue skies thing where they have, you know, you can do so much of your free time.
Right.
And so they've actually done a lot of good security research, but now they're doing it for real. So it's not just people doing it in their spare time. It's a funded actual project within Google. And the more of these 0 days that get found by Google and get fixed, the better it is, because these 0 days are what the CIA and all those people are using to spy on us.
So are they doing this just out of altruism?
They're doing it. I would think a very strong motivator has been the Snowden revelations. They don't want to be spied on.
Okay.
So, you know, they think it's in their best interest to secure the internet better.
Okay.
Which it is.
Yeah. Okay.
A related story, the EFF are suing the NSA for hoarding zero-day exploits, because basically that damages the security of the whole nation.
Yeah.
So, then we have two little PSAs here. So the first one is there is a thing going on in the States at the moment, but the risk is everywhere. There are people putting keyloggers in public computers in hotels.
That's a newsflash?
Well, there were a whole bunch of people arrested for doing it, so that makes it news.
Okay.
But it is a PSA to, you know, this is an opportune moment to remind you to beware of public computers. They are dangerous, inherently right. dangerous. Also, if you have an Android phone and you've wiped it and you've sold it on, it's probably not as wiped as you think.
You know, I wrote to Father Robert Ballaser about this because they were talking about it on Android, All About Android.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, he said the way I just read it from Apple.
Hey, Allison, sorry, you dropped out there, which is really ironic given our pre-recorded conversation.
We were just talking about how it never dies on us. But here's an interesting thing, Bart. I saw a blink, and I kept talking, and you disappeared and came back right at the end of my sentence. So except for the part where you don't know what I said, as far as the audience would have been concerned, they would have never known.
Okay, good.
What I said was that I wrote to Father Robert Ballaser, who did not respond. Mm-hmm. He was on All About Android, and he said that it isn't just a problem with Android, that no phones sold today can be wiped and really be wiped. And that's why,
yes.
And that's why I sent you the knowledge base article that described how iPhones what they do is they are the current models. They just remove the encryption key when you say reset to factory settings.
Yeah. Any device that has full disk encryption, when you delete that encryption key, the entire device is random noise. That goes for your computers with full disk encryption turned on, and it goes for our iPhones. And the fact that Android is not full disk encryption is a genuine problem. And if the Android people don't realize how insecure they are, that's an even bigger problem.
Yeah, so why does that make them so insecure? I'm not sure.
Because the only way to wipe a phone that's not encrypted is to go over every single bit in its many, many, many gigabytes of memory.
Right. But this is only important if you're getting rid of the device, or is this also...
Or if it's stolen, or if you lose it.
Yeah. Okay. Right.
I think it's nuts to wander around. Like, if you think of... My phone has more personal information about me than any other device on this planet, and it is also the most stealable device I own.
Right.
That's a bad combination. I feel really good that I have a fully encrypted device.
Yeah. I hadn't really thought about it until this came up.
So okay,
I better stop being interested in what you're saying, Bart.
Yeah, because we're heading way too long here. Those nice people at Microsoft made a mega Uber boo-boo.
Hmm.
A misguided attempt at taking down a botnet basically had Microsoft take over another company's infrastructure without that company getting to have their day in court. They then proceeded to fumble, utterly destroying the company's service by being incapable of providing it themselves. Apparently Azure is not as good as Microsoft say. And basically... They achieved nothing apart from disrupting at least thousands, if not more, NoIP customers. So they went to a judge. They went, NoIP don't have a proper complaints process. Their stuff is being abused by a botnet. You need to give us the authority to steal their DNS without telling them first. And some judge who obviously has no understanding of people's right to due process said, oh, okay then. And so NoIP, without ever getting to defend themselves in court, had their entire business taken away from them by Microsoft.
Yeah, that actually hit directly to home. Our friends over at Alpha Geek Radio, who live broadcast this the live show and play reruns for us, were affected by that. Basically, Todd Whitehead servers essentially didn't exist on the internet anymore because of what Microsoft did.
Yeah, so NoIP is a dynamic DNS service. So if you want to have a DNS name for your home internet connection, which is always changing IP, you need some sort of service that your home computers can check in with every time your DSL company changes your IP, and then always update that record so that you can get to your computer at home via a nice name. And well, that's what NoIP does.
I guess I should say even closer to home, that's exactly the service that we used in the exercise that Donald Burr took us through to build our own VPN servers. We used NoIP to do that. So literally, it brought it home.
Yeah, I mean, hundreds of thousands of people all around the planet use NoIP to connect back to their houses because they're on dynamic IPs and they need a dynamic DNS service. NoIP is an entirely legitimate company. There is nothing, there's not even a sniff of malware about them. And they have a proper complaints procedure. They have a long history of working with security researchers to shut down botnets. Microsoft was wrong in every possible way here, as well as being incompetent. They just failed to hold up the infrastructure. And the judge who made this possible Well, I believe the phrase is sometimes justice is an ass. Well, I believe it was.
I just hope no IP is well-funded now.
Yes, exactly. I guess this is no such thing as bad publicity, maybe.
Well, I'm just hoping Microsoft has to fund them for some stuff. I hope there's some. I'm not a fan of lawsuits, but I think if you take my whole business down unjustifiably, that might talk to
See, the
lawyer.
Problem is the judge technically did it, and I don't think he can sue judges.
Okay.
I'm not a lawyer, but
interested.
Anyway.
I said I wasn't going to be interested.
Yeah, well, speaking of the injustice or whatever, well, that's not a good segue. But anyway, Facebook managed to really annoy people as well. They thought it would be fun to experiment on people's mood. And they succeeded. And they were very pleased with themselves, and they published a journal paper, and they have no idea why everyone's cranky at them.
You know, I was fascinated by this article, and I could talk for hours about it. The thing I found really interesting is I asked many of my young friends of my kids, and none of them, A, heard about it, B, cared when I told them. They're like, what? Oh, okay, whatever.
It's a generational thing, then, because I find the concept of Google toying with the emotions
Not
of
Google.
Thousands.
Not Google.
Sorry. Ah, I keep doing that.
Not that
Sorry,
they wouldn't.
Facebook.
But.
Yeah, the thoughts of Facebook toying with the emotions of hundreds of thousands of people, if not millions of people, just to test a little theory they had, that to me is just nuts. You don't experiment on the mental health of people. They intentionally tried to make people angry. That could have backfired quite horribly.
Yeah, yeah. Like I said, I could talk about this one for hours.
Yeah.
I have many opinions. We should just yak about it offline, I guess. But anyway.
I think so, but there are the UK Information Commissioner has launched an investigation. There are lawsuits flying around. I don't believe this story is over yet.
Good.
Now, there's a new section here that we've never had before, security news commentary, because basically there were new stories that I think I want to set the record straight on one of them, and I think you want to set the record straight on the other.
Okay.
So there was a story, it's a research paper, it is correct. Mathematicians have done the math. Humans are really bad at making up random stuff. Therefore, if humans have to make up too many passwords, they're all rubbish. So it's better off to use a crappy password that you reuse on all the sites you don't care about and make up a few good passwords, mathematically speaking. The thing is, in the modern world, why are we limiting ourselves to passwords humans make up? We have password generators. Password generator plus password manager equals properly secure. No need to use insecure passwords. We have technology. So the research is correct, but I don't think anyone should follow its advice because way better off to use a password generator and a password manager. And if you're on a Mac, just use Safari. It'll generate your passwords. It'll save your passwords. Problem solved.
I actually yelled at Steve for putting this one in our Google Plus community.
No, but that gave me an opportunity to write this reply.
Okay, well, good. But I was just like, Steve, you're a troll.
yeah, arguably. And then on a similar one, I know you were quite exercised about a story about that affected LastPass. Do you want to talk about that one?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember exactly what they said they did find. There were some problems with LastPass and some other password managers where they found, what was it? With LastPass, there's a way you can create these little bookmarklets, and there was some flaw in the bookmarklets, like, I don't know, late 2013, so quite a long time ago, you know, 6 months ago. And people were passing this article around saying, oh, LastPass is insecure. And so were all these other places. It was LastPass, Password Box, RoboForm, My One Login, Need My Password. And and they said all that people were throwing it around like it was a big, huge thing. But what the article actually said, if you read deeply into it, was you're still way, 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 way better off if you use one of these tools than you try to do it yourself. I mean, your chances of being cracked are so much higher if you try to do it without a password manager than if you don't. And I thought it was very well written. I thought that was a good point. And they also said just because you don't see the password manager you're using in this list does not mean that we didn't or that it's also completely 100% secure. So people were saying, well, okay, I better not use LastPass. I'll use 1Pass. And well, maybe, but they didn't test 1Password because they were just looking at web-based applications.
Yeah. So they looked at 5. They found problems in 5. They reported those problems to the 5 vendors. One of those vendors completely ignored them. So Need My Password are very much in the bad books because they didn't respond. The other 4 vendors all responded promptly and correctly and fixed the problems. And all of this was done before anything was released to the public. In other words, responsible disclosure, responsible attitude by the vendors. This is how security is supposed to work. This is a good news story, not a bad news story.
Yeah, it's always going to be whack-a-mole. It's how fast can you play whack-a-mole.
We get back to our last discussion. Programmers make mistakes. Always. Programmers are human. So what matters is how a company responds when a security researcher comes to them and says, here's a bug.
Right.
If they respond promptly, that is the company I want managing my stuff.
Right.
Because everyone has bugs. And so you can either stick your head in the sand and pretend you don't, or you can deal with them.
All right. So, all right, we're at 25 minutes, by the way.
Yes, so I'm going to say that if you have a CNET account, whoops, Russian hackers stole a million passwords. A million! And then there's loads more suggested reading, and I'm going to leave it at that.
Okay. All right, so let's see. As we get started in Taming the Terminal, Part 19 of N,
mm-hmm.
Let's go ahead and get stuck in.
Okay, so where last we left our hero, we had just learned about regular expressions, which are a way of representing patterns. And I said that we would use these patterns for the purposes of searching. Because when you're searching, you're looking for a thing. And the way you represent that thing is by describing a pattern, which you do with regular expressions.
Okay.
And when we were learning about regular expressions, we used the command egrep to test, you know, sort of to test our regular expressions. But we didn't really go into egrep. We just sort of said, take it on faith that this egrep command works. So now it's time that we actually make friends with egrep and really look into what egrep does.
Okay.
Because egrep is our text searching tool. And so our finding stuff, which is where we're heading here, is going to be broken into two halves. There's a text search half, and then there's a file search half. So this week is just text search, and it's just the one command. It's just grep, or egrep, sorry. And then in future installments, it might be one, it might be two more installments, we look at ways of finding files. So text search today, file search next time. So our one friend, or our two friends, depending on how you look at it, is egrep and or grep. And
what's the difference again?
The difference is subtle. Yeah, okay. So grep is the original. Right? Grep has been around for a very long time.
Okay.
And so when grep was written, our nice regular expressions that we've learned about didn't exist yet. So obviously grep doesn't do that because it didn't exist yet.
Okay.
So when POSIX EREs came out, which is the extended regular expressions we learned, they decided, well, the simplest thing to do was to make a copy of grep that did everything grep did, but using these nice new regular expressions. But they couldn't call it grep because grep already exists. So egrep is exactly the same as grep, except that it uses these nice new regular expressions.
Okay, got it.
So really, I would say if you're starting out now, ignore grep. Pretend it never existed. Always use egrep. The problem is with, you know, old farts like me, I grew up on grep. And so I am going to, whether no matter how hard I try, get it wrong throughout this entire show, I'm going to say grep by mistake. I always mean egrep.
Okay, good.
And what in my real life, if you're looking for something that doesn't contain a regular expression, it doesn't actually matter which command you use because the two are identical. The only time it matters is when you do your regular expression. So the way my brain works is if I'm not looking for a regular expression, I type grep. And as soon as I look for a regular expression, I hit the back arrow and put the E that I forgot in.
Okay.
But really, I'm saying, you know, you should just do egrep from the start. It's easier.
So do as I say, not as I do.
Correct, because basically I've picked up a bad habit and I'm having a hard time breaking it.
Okay.
So egrep, hey, I got it right. Egrep can be used in two ways. So we can use it to filter the stuff that's coming in on standard in or std in, or we can use it to filter one or more files. And there's subtle differences between the two approaches. So we're going to look at them independently. And we're going to start by filtering std in or standard in, which takes us back a few weeks to this whole thing where, remember, we did stream redirection where you could use the pipe operator to take the output of one command as the input to another command.
Right. Ooh, do we get to grep to more? I've always wondered.
Well, the other way around, you generally speaking will use grep to filter something else. So you'll do a command which makes too much output.
Oh, right. You grep and then pipe to more. These are words I hear. I used to hear at work, and I never knew what they meant.
I suppose you could, right? Okay.
This is garbage in, garbage out.
You would do something, pipe it to grep, to filter it down to just what you're interested in. And if what you're interested in is more than one page, then you could pipe it on to more later.
Okay. At some point, I'll know what that all meant.
Okay. Well, at some point, very soon.
I'm just being silly.
So it's quite, it's not at all unreasonable. It happens all the time. In fact, you'll have a command which gives you a whole bunch of output, but you're not interested in all of it. And therefore, you want to filter it down. And so the way egrep works when you're using stdin is that every line that comes into it, one by one, so one line at a time, it works sort of the quanta of egrep is a line. It doesn't look at one character, then the next character. It looks at one line, then the next line. So each line gets looked at. If the line matches the pattern, it gets sent to standard out. If the line doesn't match the pattern, it vanishes off into a black hole. It is gone.
Hmm.
So if you imagine that you get 5 million lines in, only 5 of them match your pattern, then there's just 5 lines in the output. And so it is a filter.
Okay.
Right? So stuff that matches the pattern goes through, everything else gets blocked. And if you spend some time on the terminal doing sysadmin stuff, you are going to spend time looking at log files because that's where computers talk. And when you're trying to debug something, you want to listen. But most log files are fairly chatty places, especially on a live server that's doing real stuff. And so you will invariably want to watch what's happening in a log file, but only see the stuff that matches what you're doing. And so I have below a real-world example from that I use very regularly at work, but unfortunately, it's not one we can do here because we don't all run DNS servers. So I'm going to do a real-world example, and then we're going to do a slightly more contrived example on our Macs.
Okay.
So in the real world, at work, one of the things I'm responsible for is our DNS server. And the DNS server is very good about saying what it's up to, but it writes to a centralized log file, which is a really common log file in Linux, which is var log messages. And pretty much anything can send stuff to messages. Now, the DNS server is polite enough to prefix all of its messages with named colon, because named is the name server daemon. So that means that everything that comes into Verilog messages that starts with name D is of interest, and nothing else is. So if we remember back even a little further to the tail minus F command, do you remember what that does?
No, I'm sorry.
It sends a file to standard out, but it keeps looking at the file. So as stuff comes into the file in real time, tail sends it out. So it allows you to watch a file in real time. So tail minus F slash Verilog messages would just show you the log file in real time, scrolling by. Scroll, 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 scroll.
Okay.
Every single message. But we want to filter that big, long, noisy message file. So we use our pipe operator to pipe that entire big glop of messages that are just flowing by us constantly into egrep.
Okay.
And then egrep in this mode only needs one argument, which is the pattern to apply. And so we say pipe egrep, and then space our regular expression, which in this case is the hat symbol, which means...
Is that a wildcard? Ends in start, named? Or starts
start, with? No, starts with.
Oh, okay.
So starts with name D colon is the pattern. And if I was on my DNS server in work and I hit enter on that, all of a sudden the lots and lots of messages coming by in Verilog messages would be filtered down to only the DNS messages. And I can then work away and do what I want to do, and I'll only see what I care about. And all the other messages are just hidden from me. And it works in real time. So I'm watching the live log file only filtered.
Okay.
Which is very useful to be able to do. But our Macs are not servers. So that means that log files on a Mac, they exist. There's lots of log files on a Mac. But they're not very talkative. They'll have like, you know, 5 or 6 entries an hour. Which is no fun for this kind of thing, right? So right. Instead, what I was looking for was a command that is guaranteed to make lots of output. And in our modern computers, the single thing we can rely on is that there is network traffic to our computers. Because our messenger apps, in this case, we're going to have lots of traffic because we're Skyping with each other, web browsing, email client, Twitter client, our computers are just constantly chatting on the network. So if we were to have, say, a terminal command to print out every single network packet that came to your computer, we would have a big long stream of data to fly by on the screen that we could then use egrep to filter. As it happens, there is such a command. And this is a sneak peek, right? I promise you we are coming back to this. So for today, you're going to take this command on faith with the understanding that when we come to the networking section of this Taming the Terminal series, we are going to go into this in proper detail. So the command, which we're going to do without filtering first so that we can see what it does, is sudo space tcp dump space minus I space any space minus nn. Now, the sudo command is because only the root user has the power to dump the network details, which is wise, because that's a security feature. And then tcp dump dumps every tcp packet flying through your network card. Minus I means use any network card, so whether using Wi-Fi or Ethernet, we want it all. And then the minus NN we'll ignore for now.
Okay.
But we do need it for our example.
Okay,
so if you hit enter
that,
on that...
There's all kinds of crapola all over my screen.
Yeah, it should be a constant stream flowing past.
It's dumping some TCP all over me.
Now, in fact, we should be seeing an awful, awful, awful lot of UDP.
I am seeing a lot of UDPs.
Which is because Skype is a UDP protocol. So those basically, those UDP packets are Skype packets. But if you open up a browser window and start browsing around, you'll see TCP packets flow by as well. If you click refresh mail, you'll see a whole bunch of mail traffic go by. Basically, everything your computer does in the network is scrolling by you here, and it's a lot. Therefore, it is worth filtering. So what you'll see is it's time and then the protocol, which is IP usually. Then it's going to be the source IP address, source port, arrow, destination IP address, destination port, and then some more glob.
Okay.
And so we just see all this network traffic. You have a lot of that. Good. So we'll hit Control C to get ourselves out of that. I don't know about you, but I captured 5,325 packets in that time.
Okay. I got about 8,500, so I'm doing good.
You're really busy on the network. So now we're going to use egrep to filter that. What we actually want to do is we want to use egrep to filter that for only DNS traffic, because that's a nice simple thing. So to make that filter, we need to know two facts about DNS. So firstly, DNS uses port 53, which means we're going to be filtering on 53 because that's the DNS port. The other thing we know about DNS is that it is only going to our DNS server, because that's what our DNS server is for. And almost everyone who's listening to this, I won't say everyone because there's always an exception somewhere, but just about everyone who's listening to this is using their router as their DNS server because that's how every home router sold in the last decade works. So what we need to know is the IP address of our router. Now, we could make a guess because if you have an Apple router, it's 10.0.0.1.
Right.
And if you have a router from most other manufacturers, it's 192.168.0.1. But guessing isn't a very good idea.
A lot of them are 192.168.1.1.
Ah, there you go. So guessing, not good. So we don't have to guess. In fact, we can use egrep to figure out what our router address is as well. Hmm. So we have another sneak peek we can do. So another command that I promise you we'll be returning to again is the command netstat, which gives us basically statistics about our network, as the name suggests, netstat. So in this case, what we're interested in is our routing table, which tells the computer how it talks to the internet. And specifically what we want is the default root, which is the fancy name for our router. So the command, which will work on all of our Macs and any Linux machine, is netstat space minus or n pipe egrep. And then the pattern is starts with default, so hat default.
Okay.
So if you copy there and you get back one line of answer, it says default tab and IP address tab glop we don't care about.
Yep, 10.0.1.1.
Okay.
So, that
so remember
is,
that IP address.
So that's my router.
That's your router.
Okay.
So what we are interested in from TCP dump is stuff going to a router on port 53. And TCP dump has a bizarre convention. It uses, it basically sticks the port number on the end of the IP address as an extra dot. So what you're actually looking to egrep is your IP address dot 53 colon. So for me, because my network is a bit special, I'm 192.168.10.1. So the first command there is the command I'm actually using. So sudo space tcp dump space minus I any minus nn, just like before, pipe egrep, and in my case 192.168.10.1.53 colon. And so if I stick that in, I will start to see initially probably very little go by until you open up a web browser and go to a web page that isn't cached. So I don't know where you haven't been yet today, maybe whitehouse.gov.
Okay.
And assuming you've changed that IP address, obviously, to your own router, you should see all of your DNS queries going out.
Yeah, that's a lot.
But you should also see what address you're querying for. So you can see that whitehouse.gov is, it doesn't just contain itself. So all every little widget in there that needs code from somewhere else is going to generate another DNS query.
Wow, that's a lot of crap.
Yeah.
Vimeo, petitions.whitehouse.gov, plus.google.com.
Yeah.
Facebook, Foursquare, LinkedIn.
Flickr. I mean, there's all sorts of garbage in all of these modern web pages.
Oh, yeah. Look, okay, because it's because at the bottom of the page it has Facebook, Twitter, Google+, YouTube. I don't even know what that symbol is. LinkedIn. Actually, I could look up here and probably find out. Wow.
So this is every DNS request your browser had to do to render that web page. And all of that other glop is still happening, but the grep filter is just hiding it from us.
Wow.
So this way we can just watch what DNS we do. You know, somewhat arbitrary, but it, you know, it shows the power of the...
I just start going to some of these addresses, like what's m.addthisedge.com? Sorry, I should stop playing around.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it's kind of amazing what's going on here. Like, and you'll find that sort of the simpler mom-and-pop websites don't have any of this glop. But the more corporate you get, the more of these trackers. And these are ad trackers and all sorts of things.
Yeah, I didn't expect to see that much on whitehouse.gov. But, well, there's got to be all the NSA stuff in there too, right?
Yeah, I wonder where some of those servers are. Anyway, it's Facebook, LinkedIn, Flickr, loads of stuff there. So the point is, we have filtered that giant big stream of data into only a very specific type of data. So we have used egrep to filter standard in.
Mm-hmm. Very cool.
So this is our first example. So the other way we can use egrep then, if I can find my show notes again, go away, whitehouse.gov. So the other way we can use egrep is to filter files. So not a stream that's coming from a command, but to look through files for a thing. And in fact, when we were doing our regular expression examples, that's what we were doing. We were using egrep to look through the words file.
Right. I remember that. That was my favorite episode so far, by the way, just because I found out I could cheat it at Scrabble.
Scrabble. So as a little reminder to ourselves, I have one of the examples.
Wait, no,
that we
crossword
did.
Puzzles.
Crossword puzzles, that's it. So egrep and then the pattern. So when you're using it on files, egrep must have at least two arguments. The first argument is the pattern you're looking for, and the second argument is the file you're looking for the pattern in. And if you want to look for the file in more than, or the pattern in more than one file, you can keep specifying as many files as you like. But you got to have at least one, because otherwise egrep has nothing to look in, and it will just say, well, so the example I have is just to look in the words file for everything starting with th. There's a lot of those. So egrep space hat sign for start of line th. /user/share/dict/words. And that gives us our whole big list of th words.
Right.
Which is just an example from last time. But of course, in the real world, you're probably not trying to... you might be trying to cheat in crosswords, but you're probably doing something else. So again, we're doing the same sort of idea, a real world example from my life as a sysadmin, and then we'll do a different example that we can all do in our Macs. So one of the things you have to do a lot when you're dealing with servers for a living is you need to figure out how a setting is set. And just about every server has a config file, and that config file has a bunch of keys. Basically, setting name and then the value of the setting, usually with an equal sign between them. Sometimes it's a different symbol. But you may want to know, oh, how is bloody blah feature configured? Egrep, the feature you're looking for, the config file in question. Very, very common type of thing to need to do. So the example I have is a PHP example. So if you're running a web server that has PHP, there's a file called php.ini, which is PHP's settings file. And PHP has like a kabillion settings. But one that you often have to tinker with is the max file size, or the upload max file size. In other words, the biggest file that you will accept as an upload from a user. If you make it too small, people can't upload stuff you may want. If you make it too big, you may do yourself a horrible denial of service. So it's an important one to get right.
Is the php.ini file giant, so you can't just scan it with your eyeballs?
It is hundreds and hundreds of lines long.
Oh, okay.
So you could scan it with your eyeballs, but you'll be there for a while. So okay. It's much easier to quickly grep it. So the example command simply looks for a line that starts with upload_max_file_size in the file /etc/php.ini. And it will just give you a little instant one-line answer. When Mike and on my server, it's still set up the default, 2 megabytes. Upload file size equals 2M. Very straightforward.
So that doesn't
and I know
help
the
you change it. That just tells you what did I set it to?
Right, because that is usually when you're trying to debug something, your first question is this a problem?
What
I have
do
it set
already?
To yeah, okay. I have it set to 15 megs, and the person's trying to upload a 5K zip file. This is not my problem. I must now look somewhere
something
else.
Something else. Okay.
Yeah. So let's slightly arbitrary, but let's do an example on our Macs. Every Unix, Linux, and OS X machine has a file called /etc/resolve.conf, which contains the DNS configuration for our Macs or our Linux machines.
Hmm.
So I said to you that just about everyone uses a router as their DNS server, but actually we could check if that's true. So we will. So we're going to, so basically that file will have one or more entries that start with name server and then contain an IP address. So if you have two DNS servers configured, you'll get two lines back. If you have one DNS server configured, which is the norm for a home computer, if you're in a corporate environment, you probably have more than one DNS server configured because most corporations have multiple DNS servers. But anyway, so the command is egrep space, and then the pattern is #, for start of line, name server, and then you look in /etc/resolve.conf, and it should come back with probably one line that says name server and the IP address of your router, probably.
Yeah, it did. 10.0.1.1. And I even cheated and did a more on that file, and I can see it's a little bitty file, but the very last line says name server is 10.0.1.1. So it didn't even lie.
And, you know, if you were in a corporate environment, you would almost certainly have more than one come back there.
Right, right.
But, anyway, it'll tell you what your name servers are. So you can use egrep. See, I knew I was going to do that.
First time. Very good.
To search a single file, which is great. But you can search as many as you want. And the nice thing is that egrep is smart enough that if it gets more than one file as an input, it will prefix the name of the file before the answer.
Oh.
Yeah, which is, otherwise it will be pretty useless. Because, oh great, it found it somewhere.
In one of those 48 files you told me to look at. Thanks.
Exactly. So it does that all by itself. You don't even have to do anything. So if you give it more than one file, it will prefix the name of the file into the start of the results. And the most common reason you would want to do this would be to look at, say, all log files in a folder.
Oof.
And so you can use the shell's star expansion, the shell's wildcard, to basically look through multiple files. So a somewhat contrived example is the command to look for the pattern apple.com in all log files in /var/log. And if you run that, you'll probably see quite a few if you're on a Mac, and you'll probably see none if you're on Linux.
Hmm. Okay.
And so if you do that, you will notice that every line that is returned is prefixed with something, 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 with the name of a file and then the content of the file.
You know what I don't like about the terminal? You have to spell everything right. I typed long instead of log and it didn't know what I was talking about. I've misspelled almost everything you've told me so far.
We go back to my whole thing of computers are dumb.
You know what I meant.
Yes, I know.
Okay, let's see. So I'm looking at all this glop.
And every line, now, if you have word wrap on, it may not be obvious where a line starts, but if you wiggle with the width of your terminal window, you'll soon see what's the start of line. And you'll see they all start with /var/log/somefilename.log.
Oh, there it is. Okay, yeah.
And so you'll see what's going on.
Huh.
Now, the chances are you would be doing this to solve a real problem. So you may have a problem with a particular app. So you're probably going to be using egrep to look for a particular app. But since I didn't know what everyone has installed, this is an arbitrary example because I figured apple.com's got to be in those logs somewhere. But you can see how you would use this same structure to search for things that you care about, whatever you're trying to achieve.
Very cool.
So the last thing I just want to
add, I'm not saying I'll remember next week or 2 weeks from now when you say, remember when I told you this, but I understood everything so far.
Okay, well, I'm hoping that the last very small little bit won't be any problem. So like all other terminal commands, egrep takes a few flags. And in fact, it doesn't just take a few flags. Egrep is a pretty full-featured thing. So if you actually want to see them all, you can type man egrep. Make yourself a cup of coffee.
Yeah, that's a lot of...
Yeah, so I just thought it might be worth mentioning three that you're most likely to want. Just sort of pick out three favorites and then leave the rest as an exercise to the reader. So probably the single one that I use most often in the real world is -i, which stands for case insensitive.
Oh. So if you're not... have to spell it right, but you don't have to remember whether it's upper or lowercase.
Exactly. And quite often I don't remember whether, you know, does Apache capitalize the first letter of that particular variable name? I don't know. I'll just use a -i.
Is there a -s for don't have to spell it right?
No, I'm afraid that would involve intelligence on behalf of the computer.
Right, right.
Another one that can be very handy is the -n flag, which means that as well as giving you the name of the file at the start, if you're doing a big search, it will give you the line number.
Oh.
So if you have a really big file, you will then know where in the file it is. You know, is it on line one or is it on line 3000?
Right.
You know, which is potentially very useful. Especially when you know that if you go in VI and you type colon and then hit a number and hit enter, it'll jump you to that line. So if you know that you need to be on line 5021, you type VI space, the name of the file, enter, colon 1001, and it'll take you straight to that line. So that can be very helpful, the minus N. And then the last one to mention is the big gun. And I would say use this with caution. Not because you can damage anything, but you just might make your computer work very hard. So the minus OR flag will allow you to make grep check every single file in every single folder in a given starting point.
So if you start up kind of high?
So if you did grep some pattern minus OR slash, it will look on every single file in your computer. And it will take forever, ever, 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 ever. Much more reasonable that you might want to start off maybe in a folder inside your documents folder and check everything in there. So, minus OR is really useful, but don't make it look through 20 kabillion files. There are better ways to look through 20 kabillion files, and we'll come to those in future installments.
That's excellent. So I have to ask one question. Is there, mm-hmm. there's a minus capital R too, right?
Which does exactly the same thing.
Okay.
As does minus minus recursive.
Oh, okay.
So basically, everything that you might guess to mean recursive does recursive.
Okay.
Which is very friendly of it.
Definitely. Definitely is.
So really, that's where we're going to leave it now. That is text searching done. And I mean, it was a fairly short little description all in all, given some of the Taming the Terminal segments we've had. But I can honestly say that in terms of my day-to-day life, there's more of this in my day-to-day life than anything else we've covered so far in the 18 previous segments.
Wow.
This is what you do. You look for stuff.
Yeah, I like this little bite-sized chunk better because it might hold in my brain a little longer because it's not as much. Sometimes I get buffer overflow on...
Well, the main reason it was bite-sized is because I saw the size of the security segment.
Oh, good, good. Yeah,
that's take a nibble today.
Yeah, I have to say, you had me nervous when we were at 25 minutes, but we came in just fine here. All right, well, hey, so you're on next week hosting the show.
I am hosting next week.
Now, if people want to send you in segments, what address should they use?
The easiest one is probably podcasting@bartificer.net, BARTIFICER.net, which is the address I use for all of my podcasty stuff, be it my shows or whatever.
podcast@bartificer.net.
That's the one.
All right. I will make sure to put that in the show notes before and after and to make sure people know how to send you in segments because you would like some help, right?
Absolutely. No, I mean, the listeners have always been great every time I've hosted before. I now got to find someone to talk to across a pond, but I'm sure I'll find someone.
I'm sure you will. All right, Bart. Thanks a lot. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah, cheers. And until next time, happy computing.
Well, that's going to wind it up for this week. Many thanks to our sponsor for helping to pay the bills, Blue Mango Learning at bluemangolearning.com, makers of Clarify. And don't forget, we're going to have a coupon on to buy Clarify 2 when it comes out in the next week or two. So I'm getting really excited. Do not forget to send in your dumb questions, comments, and suggestions to me at allison@podfeet.com. Follow me on Twitter and app.net@podfeet. And be sure to check out the NoSilcast Google Plus community. I think there were like 5 or 6, 7 great questions going on. People diving in, helping each other. It's really fun. That's at podfeet.com/Google+. If you want to join in the fun of the live show, which was not on this week, I'm sorry to say. It's very lonely doing this recording all by myself without snarky comments from the chat room. Anyway, if you want to do that next time, and I guess that'd be in 2 weeks, head on over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time and join the friendly and enthusiastic NoSilla Castaways. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.